Mitch Steele joins me this week to discuss the latest in IPA beer styles. This is Beersmith Podcast number 194.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 194, and it's early June 2019. Mitch Steele joins me this week to discuss the latest trends and techniques for IPAs. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for beer brewers and beer lovers. They are currently offering 20% off their all-access pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It also has the integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for juice, honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Mitch Steele. Mitch wrote the book on IPAs called IPAs, Brewing Techniques and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. Mitch is COO and brewmaster at New Realm Brewing Company, and formerly the brewmaster at Stone. Mitch holds a degree in fermentation science from the University of California at Davis and has been on several times before. It's great to have you back, Mitch. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's see, about 2 years ago, we had you on to talk about your startup at New Realm Brewing, which I think is where you are now. How are things going at the new brewery?
Yeah, things are good. We've been open a year and a half. We had some growing pains our first year. This year has started off very well. A lot of growth in the restaurant and also in distribution. So we're making a lot of beer. Last year, we bought the Green Flash Brewery that was shut down in Virginia Beach. And so we've started operations up there, and we're brewing a lot of beer. And
over if I remember right, you're near Atlanta. Is that correct?
We are in Atlanta.
Yeah, in Atlanta, yeah. Downtown, yeah. Right?
Yep.
But you now have a location in Virginia Beach, right?
Yeah. It was kind of an interesting thing. We had just started talking about building a production facility because this brewery here in Atlanta, it's a 20-barrel brew house, and we have about 10,000, 11,000 barrels of annual capacity. And we started off like gangbusters, and we were scared we were going to run out of capacity pretty early. So we were starting to talk about building a production facility, and then Green Flash shut down their brewery in Virginia Beach and laid everybody off and put the brew house, all the equipment up for auction. And we took a look at it and said, holy smokes, we could get, you know, what we were talking about spending a gazillion dollars on, we can get for a fairly reasonable price, and we don't have to go through the process of building it. And so we kind of took a look at it from a business standpoint, and it made a lot of sense. And so we ended up bidding on the brewing equipment in Virginia Beach, and we got it. And then we negotiated a long-term lease with the person who owned the building. And so we are there and brewing beer. And actually, the three brewers that I have on the team there all used to work for Green Flash. So they came back, and which is great because they know the system, they know the brewery, and they know how to make beer. So it was a pretty good situation for us. Over the winter, we built they had a tap room in there that didn't have any seats or anything. It was basically just a walk-up bar, and you bought a beer, and then you stood around and drank the beer, which works for a lot of people. But, you know, we do things a little different. So over the winter, we built a restaurant and kitchen in there. And so we started full service restaurant service and the bar sometime in April. I think it was about mid-April. So we've been running it for about a month now.
That's awesome. And how big is that? You said you have 20 barrels in Atlanta. How big is the other one?
Yeah, the brewery in Virginia Beach is a Mueller brew house. It's a 50-barrel brew house. And one of the things that's kind of neat about it is it's got two kettles. And that, they put that in there for capacity reasons because the kettle is the longest residence time of any process in the brew house. So if you have two kettles, you can theoretically get a lot more beer through. You know, when we were at Stone, we put in a holding kettle there, and it gained us 20% capacity by putting in that next tank. But the nice thing about that is that we can do kettle sours there, and we can put a ladder off a brew and add lactic acid bacteria in the kettle and hold it, and we can brew around it if we have to and use the other kettle. So that's kind of a neat option.
That's really cool. Yeah, that gives you, you can kettle sour potentially for a couple of days, right, before you have to move on, right?
Yeah, and you can keep brewing, and that's the beauty of it.
Nice. Well, I do want to shift gears. You'd want to talk about IPAs today, and of course, you literally wrote the book on IPAs, as I mentioned on the intro, right?
Right.
But you published it way back in 2012 now, and quite a few things have changed. I think a lot of breweries are making like 60% or more of their beer as IPAs, and a lot of new techniques, a lot of new styles. What are some of the things that have changed since you published your book?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it was interesting. I knew everything was going to change. I mean, just how fast this industry moves. And I remember thinking that all the historical data was going to be quickly out of date, and that really hasn't happened. But of course, the IPA style, as it's grown in popularity, has evolved a lot, and people are doing a lot of interesting twists. And so, you know, what I've seen happen is, you know, there was a period where people were adding all sorts of fruits and coffee and other interesting ingredients to IPA to kind of augment the hops or complement the hop flavor. And that was going on a lot shortly after the book got released. Mm-hmm. And Dick Cantwell wrote a really good book about that, you know, brewing eclectic IPAs, and covered a lot of that material in his book. But, you know, the hazy IPA thing, that has just gone bonkers. And, you know, the New England IPA style. And it's interesting because I remember 3 years ago when we started planning our brewery that we were building at Stone in Richmond, Virginia, I went to a brew pub called The Answer. And that's part of Mekong, which is a great beer bar in Richmond, Virginia. But anyway, I was talking to their brewmaster, and he's like, yeah, I'm making all my IPAs hazy. And I had just started kind of hearing about New England IPA. And he goes, that's all we're doing. And I'm like, really? Wow, that's very interesting, you know, that it has kind of gone out of New England and it's becoming less of a niche and more of a mainstream kind of offering. And of course, now, you know, 3 years later, if you don't have a hazy IPA, you're missing a great opportunity because that's what people want to drink. And so that's been incredibly interesting to see. And also, you know, just learning about the science that goes on and the biochemistry that happens in those beers, it's actually fascinating. And then recently, you know, just about a year ago, I started hearing about brewed IPA, and that's been a real interesting phenomenon as well. And we've brewed a bunch of them. I kind of miss the hazy IPA thing because I wasn't brewing for 2 years, and right when the hazy IPA thing really started taking off. But the brewed IPA thing, as soon as I heard about it, we brewed one, and so that was kind of fun, and we were on the cutting edge of that, at least for Georgia.
Nice. Yeah, and we're going to talk about both those styles in detail, but I was wondering if you could mention some of the other sub-styles that have popped up since you published your book. There's quite a few of them, if I recall.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are going on that I think are interesting. I think in the Southeast in general, and I've had to learn a lot about the beer scene here, which is really strong, but it's different. You know, the IPAs that are popular here tend to be more bittered, like like back 20 years ago, you know, as far as IBU levels. So, you know, a lot of the IPAs that are really popular in the Southeast are about 50 IBUs. And, you know, people have gone away from the 70 to 80 IBU West Coast IPA thing here. And tropical hops have really become part of the structure. Session IPAs also are doing really well. You know, there are a lot of people that are brewing 4.5% IPAs and having a lot of success with those. Variations on the New England hazy thing. There's a lot going on.
And, I was thinking doubles and triples too, right?
Yeah. Triple IPA is taken off. Double IPAs, which I did cover in the book. But it's interesting. You know, I think one of the things that's changed in the beer market right now, we were talking about this morning, is that if you have a year-round double IPA, it's going to struggle in the market. And not because it isn't a great beer, but because people are always looking for something new. And I think the people that are having success with Imperial IPAs or double IPAs are doing rotating beers or just special releases with them. Because, you know, they're... You know, at 8 to 9% alcohol, most bars only pour them in 8-ounce glasses, and that impacts the throughput of the beer in the bar because people are buying a smaller glass of it each time they buy one, and they're paying the same price. So, I think people are kind of gravitating towards, you know, more of the 6 and 7% IPAs for general drinking, and so, you know, we have a great double IPA, but it's just. It's not really moving. You know, it's a great beer. It does okay in our restaurants, but, you know, we sell it in an 8-ounce pour instead of a 12 or 16. And that's a turnoff, you know, so we're learning all about that.
Well, what are the top selling beers at your bar? I just out of curiosity, as far as, you know, IPAs or other.
Yeah. So it's interesting because, The restaurants in Virginia Beach and Atlanta are completely different as far as what really does well. In Atlanta, we have a 5% Belgian golden ale or single that is our best seller almost every week. And our West Coast IPA, which is called Hoplandia IPA, is also right at the top. And then we've got a German Pilsner. It's kind of a North German Pilsner. It's about 40 IBUs. And that one is doing really well for us here. And then... We came out with a hazy IPA. It's called Hazy Like a Fox, just about a year ago, and that is really starting to pick up steam. And in Virginia Beach, for a long time, we had a Munich Dunkel that we brewed just kind of on a whim that did really well up there, and so we've been brewing it every month. And it continues to be a real top seller up in Virginia Beach, but the Hazy IPA is doing really well also.
And Atlanta, is it different?
Yeah, so Atlanta, it's you know, the single, the Belgian single and the West Coast IPA tend to do the best, and the hazy's coming up. And then some of the more traditional beer styles and German beer styles do better in Virginia Beach. And I think probably because there's you know, such a large military presence in Virginia Beach. I'm just speculating there, but certainly it is a major part of that society up there.
Interesting. Okay, well, today we wanted to dive into the Brut and Hazy IPAs, and I thought maybe we'd just start with the Brut style. Can you describe overview of what the style is and what it tastes like and what's different about it?
Yeah, I think Brut, for those who aren't familiar with it, is a term used primarily for champagne, and it refers to the driest champagne. And so, you know, following that path, you know, a Brut IPA is a very drier than normal IPA. And I first learned of this last spring in 2018, and there were a couple of breweries in the San Francisco Bay Area that were brewing them, and they were adding an enzyme in the fermenter. It's amyloglucosidase enzyme, and basically what that enzyme does is it takes all the complex sugars and starches in the, or not starches, but complex sugars and dextrins and such in the wort. And the enzyme breaks it down into glucose. And so everything that's in that beer that's a carbohydrate, all of a sudden after this enzyme addition, becomes fermentable. And so you're left with zero residual sugar in the beer. So it's incredibly dry. And typically most IPAs, if you look at IPAs today, they're finishing around 2.5 to 3.5 degrees Plato. I know your listeners probably use specific gravity, but we use Plato. So,
yeah.
But in any event, if you're looking at 2.5 to 3.5 degrees Plato as a terminal gravity, the brewed IPA
is about 10, 12, right?
Yeah.
You multiply by 4. That's kind of how you get there.
Right. the brewed IPA is finished at 0 or negative. And so it's a big difference, and the beers are drier and don't have any body to balance out the hops. So most people, when they brew a brewed IPA, instead of targeting 40 to 60 to 70 IBUs, target 25 to 30, just because there's not enough malt balance there to really balance out the bitterness. And you don't want it to be overwhelmingly bitter. So that's the big thing. I know the brewers in the Bay Area, when they first started doing this, they were using corn grits and light malts, and some of them were using champagne yeast, but we've moved away from all of that. When we brew ours, we go all malt and add the enzyme, and we're getting down to about 0 with our brewed IPAs, which is kind of cool. The one thing, the brewers, when this style first came about, they were adding the enzyme in the fermenter. And that works really great, but there's a couple of things you need to watch out for when you do that. And number one, you got to add the enzyme early enough so that the yeast don't get stressed out. And we learned that the hard way. The very first batch we did, we let the yeast ferment everything out that was fermentable. And then we added the enzyme and started breaking down those dextrins into sugars. And the yeast had to kind of start back up again. And
created some stress, maybe?
Yeah, a lot of stress, a lot of diacetyl. So it overnight, it turned into a diacetyl bomb, and then it took about 2 weeks for that diacetyl to be reconsumed because the yeast was pretty stressed. So what we learned is if you're going to add it to the fermenter, add it pretty early. So, we tend to add it day one or day two while everything is still in very active fermentation mode, and that's worked a lot better. The other thing you need to watch out for with the enzyme adding to the fermenter is that enzyme is active after the fact. So if you don't do a really good job cleaning and sterilizing and heat, you got to use heat to denature the enzyme, then whatever goes into that fermenter next could risk getting enzymatic activity and then fermenting past dryness,
Interesting. So it's almost like making a sour beer then in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's scary. We had a process detailed out for cleaning the fermenter the first time we did it, and we forgot to pull some gaskets and get rid of them on the valves, and the next beer that went in there should have finished at about 4 Plato, and it finished at 0.5. So
That's a lot. So apparently it doesn't take a lot of this enzyme to have an effect then, right?
No, it really doesn't. It's a very small amount, and I don't remember the addition rates, unfortunately. But
that's okay.
We have moved to adding the enzyme in the brew house, and we add it to the mash, and we hold the mash at about 140 degrees Fahrenheit, add the enzyme, let it sit for about 4 hours, and then we raise up to regular mashing temperature, and then process as normal, and then the boiling process in the kettle denatures the enzyme and renders it inactive.
So you don't add it during fermentation anymore then, right?
Man, we stopped. It was just, if we were going to run this beer on our can line, yeah, I didn't want to affect all the soft material in the can line with enzymes. So we figured out a way to do it in the brew house, and it works pretty well. And so we worked the enzyme supply.
So you're adding the enzyme in the mash, and then the boil, I assume, denatures it, right? Kills it off.
That's exactly right. So, the other technique that we've tried is adding it in the kettle and just not heating the mash up to a mash off temperature. So loudering at conversion temperature and letting it sit at the kettle at conversion temperature and adding the enzyme there. And that works too.
Interesting. Can you walk us through brewing a brewed IPA? Give us an idea of the ingredients. You mentioned you use a lot less hops and so on. Walk us through what it might look like.
Yeah, so where we've kind of landed with it is, first off, no specialty malts at all. So we use just a standard pale ale malt and maybe a little bit of dextrose, which adds to the fermentability and helps accentuate the dryness. Like I said, we stopped using flake corn in the beer. I know there's a lot of brewers that are making brewed IPAs that are using flake corn, but to me that it I could taste it in the final version, and I just kind of moved away from it. And we started working with all malt versions, and that worked better from a flavor standpoint. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get the dryness, you know, to go quite as far when you're going all malt, but to me it made a better tasting beer. So that's what we've done. So pretty much, you know, pale malt and maybe 10% of the fermentables from dextrose, maybe blend in some English malt in there to give it a little bit more malt character. And then from a hopping standpoint, you know, there's a lot of different approaches we could do.
Yeah, because I would imagine it really accentuates the flavor of the hops, right?
It does, you know, and so we've gone kind of, you know, like I said earlier, you know, 20, 25, 30 IBUs target. And so we tend to go with a pretty small bittering addition and then just do a lot of whirlpool hopping and get some isomerization in the whirlpool, you know, whatever the utilization is there, 10, 15, 20%, depending on the system. Yeah, and that's about it. So we're getting about 40 to 45 IBUs in the wort, and then during the course of the fermentation, as the pH drops, the IBUs drop down to below 30, and then we dry. You know, the dry hopping and the dry hopping is pretty much a standard process. And the hops that people are using, there's a lot of different approaches that people have taken here.
What varieties would come out best in something like, you know, where you have essentially just the hop flavor left?
Yeah, a lot of the brewers who started doing this were using hops that had kind of a wine-like character, you know, like the Hallertau Blanc was a real popular hop in the first brewed IPAs. And we've played around with a lot of different hops. We've done a lot of different things. We've done one with cashmere, which was really nice because cashmere has a bit of a woody character to it in the mm-hmm. background. And that really kind of worked well in the really dry beer, cause it just added an extra layer of flavor. And then we've tried traditional hops as well, you know, the Citra and Centennial and some of the sea hops and things like that. I think where I'm at right now is I like fruitier hops in a brewed IPA. So, you know,
you mentioned a lot of the Australian, New Zealand hop styles, right?
Right. You know, yeah. And those are nice. And, you know, some of the newer German varieties are really fruity and those are nice too. And they give you kind of that elegance. And, you know, so there's a lot of different ways you can go. I've had a lot of different hops in these beers, and nothing seems to be really a poor choice. I think, you know, I would stay away from dank and piney and try to hit more fruity. But that's my personal preference. And a lot of people have gone more floral and wine-like, you know. And I haven't tasted one with Nelson Sauvin. That'd be an interesting one to try, but I can't get that hop, so I haven't tried it. You know, it's a lot of good choices there. And I think it's still kind of wide open, and there's no real hop choice that has come to the forefront. I think people are just using things that they find interesting and playing around with it, which is kind of cool. And as far as yeast goes, we have used our standard house ale yeast, which is California ale yeast, and we've used that in most of them. I do know that there are a lot of brewers out there that are using champagne yeast, and I have not done that yet. The only time I've used champagne yeast in a beer, the end result had a distinctly Belgian character to it, which was very pleasant, but it was very different from what I was expecting. And so we haven't gone down that road yet, and we haven't had any fermentation problems with using our house yeast.
Yeah, it sounds like that enzyme finishes it pretty consistently. Do you have any issues with finishing the beer? I assume it Probably not, because it's going to be all fermented out, right? You don't have any hop creep issues or anything like that, right?
No. It just takes a little while to ferment. I think that's the one thing. You got to be patient with it. It takes a little bit longer to ferment down that far. And as long as the gravity is dropping at a steady rate, you're going to be fine. Mm. But that's what we saw. And again, I think the one thing that we saw that was a fermentation issue is if you're going to add enzyme to the fermenter, don't add it late, add it early in the process so the yeast don't get too stressed.
Any last tips on the brewed IPA before we move on to the next?
No, I think it's a fun style. I don't know if it's going to really take hold and take off, but they're certainly fun to brew, and they are popular here. And one of the things that we've been playing around with is doing other beers besides IPA and adding the enzyme too. So we did we've done a couple of fruited beers where we added the enzyme and got it down real dry and tried to make something more champagne-like. And I wouldn't say we hit the champagne part, but we've made some really nice beers. We did a black currant version, and we did a raspberry version and a sour cherry version, and they were all really nice and very dry. So they kind of compete with, like these berry flavored seltzers and such, and they have a nice color to them, and they've been very popular in our restaurants. So that's kind of a cool offshoot of using the enzyme and doing something a little different than the IPA.
Yeah, I got to be tough doing it with fruit though, because of course you want some residual sweetness when you're working with fruit, right? I sort of expect it, I guess.
I guess you expect it, yeah. But I mean, we've the beers that we've made have finished very dry and. In between 0 and 1 degrees Plato, and people really enjoy them. There's a lot of people that are drinking, like seltzers and flavored seltzers, and these beers kind of hit that mark for some people.
Well, let's move on to the other style you wanted to discuss, which of course is the hazy New England juicy IPA. Can you walk us through first what that style is?
Yeah. So it's an interesting, fascinating style. I think a lot of people thought I didn't like them, but I'm not one of those people. I think they're an interesting thing to brew, and I think I've always approached brewing that if there's a demand for something, you do your best to make a great one, and so that was kind of our approach with hazy IPA. So hazy IPAs and New England IPAs, there's a lot of differences between what those beers and what has become kind of the traditional craft brewed IPA. And we can start off with the grain bill. Mm-hmm. The grain bill in a hazy IPA typically has a lot of flaked wheat and flaked oats and malted oats and things that have a fairly high protein content that not only lighten the flavor of the beer, but also help accentuate the haze that you want in the finished product. So, having all that protein in the wort and in the beer helps with the haze formation, because haze is largely protein and tannins from the hops.
Yeah. Polyphenols.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you've got a strong haze component by using, 20, 30%, 40%, 50% flaked, adjuncts, and non-malted grains and malted oats are really important. One of the things I've heard, and we've just started trying this, is that American wheat malt works better for haze than German wheat malt, which I thought was interesting, because I would have expected the opposite. But that's what we're hearing from a lot of brewers in New England, is that using American wheat malt works better for haze stability, which I thought was interesting. There's some English, I'm trying to think of the English malt. There's one English malt variety that seems to do really well with haze formation, and I can't remember the name of it right now. It's not Maris Otter. It's one of the other ones. But
that's okay.
Yeah. Shoot. It'll come to me probably in a half hour. But in any event, but the malt bill is got a lot of non-barley carbohydrate sources. So I think that's a huge difference from a hopping standpoint. Oh, let's talk about water too.
Yeah, that's important.
It's really important. So the water that is used in New England IPAs, what's worked best for most brewers is using water with a really high chloride content. And a lot of brewers look at the chloride to sulfate ratio and try to go 2-to-1 chloride to sulfate, which is pretty much the polar opposite of a West Coast IPA, where you want the sulfate and you want, you want the calcium, you want the sulfate to really accentuate the bitterness. You want to do the opposite here with the New England IPA.
So
you
presumably you're accentuating maltiness, right?
Yeah, you're accentuating maltiness and softening the hop bitterness, and chloride is a really good. Really good mineral to use for softening bitterness in beer. And I remember back a long time ago in Anheuser-Busch in St. Louis, when the water would change, when you'd start getting more more salt in the water in the wintertime and things like that, we'd start getting too much bitterness, too much lingering bitterness. And AB standard was to use calcium sulfate as a water treatment. And there were periods in St. Louis where we went to calcium chloride just to help soften the bitterness just a little bit. And it's the same kind of thing here to a greater extent, though. And I think it's really a critical factor in these IPAs is accentuating the malt and softening the hop bitterness in a New England IPA. So the water profile is really important. There's a lot of stuff out there on the web about it. But in essence, a 2-to-1 chloride to sulfate ratio is what we're doing with our water.
And then you were going to discuss the hops as well.
Yeah. So hopping is very different also. It's more of this hop bursting thing, which I think I've talked about before, but very minimal bittering hops. Whirlpool hops provide most of the bitterness, and there are a number of brewers, and we've just started playing with this technique ourselves, that are going cool into the whirlpool. So they're cooling their wort as it comes off the boil and going into the whirlpool and getting the wort down below isomerization temperature, which is about 185. And so they're cooling the wort and sending it back to the whirlpool, and then adding all the whirlpool hops once the wort gets below 185. And so again, that's minimizing the bitterness and accentuating the hop flavors, which aren't going to get volatilized if the wort is cooler.
Right. And at 185, I assume you're still getting a lot of the hop oils, right?
You are, and you're just not getting the isomerization, but you're not flashing off the oils either, and so it's kind of a complicated process, and it's not something that we want to do on a regular basis, but it's been fun to play around with. That's the brew house hopping. The varieties that people are using, the most popular blend is Galaxy and Citra. That seems to be what everybody's using. And of course, Galaxy is very hard to get. We landed on a blend of Eldorado and Azaka in our main New England IPA, which is called Hazy Like a Fox. And that's a blend that works really well. And
interesting. So, yeah. Those are less common, I would think. Right.
Yeah. And we wanted to try it. And one of the things that we've heard for the dry hopping part of the process is if you have hops, if you're dry hopping in fermentation, which is a key component of New England IPA brewing, dry hopping while the yeast is in active fermentation. And then there's this whole biotransformation process that happens where oils from the hops are converted by enzymes in the yeast into different oils, and the classic one is geraniol being transformed into citronellol, and geraniol is very floral, citronellol is very juicy and orangey and citrusy, and so one of the things that's been put out there that brewers might want to look at is picking hops to use in that first dry hop that have a very high geraniol content, because you're going to get better juicy character. But that dry hopping process is radically different than what IPA brewers have done in the past. And by adding hops in the middle of fermentation, you're getting flavor changes during fermentation that are just astounding. The very first time we did it, we dry hopped at day one, and then we came in and we taste our beers every day. So we came in the next day and did the aroma check on it, and it smelled like orange juice. And it didn't after this first dry hop. It took about 24 hours, but after 24 hours, the difference was amazing. And it was just fun to kind of watch that flavor progress as the fermentation progressed. So most brewers are doing a dry hop in fermentation for a New England IPA. And then most brewers will follow that up with a more traditional dry hop, at least one dry hop post-fermentation. And so you get this really intense, massive hop flavor. You get this orange juice character from that first hop addition, and then you get whatever the character is from the hops in the late addition. And it's a really interesting process. I think one of the things that's a challenge with doing this is the yeast doesn't, you don't get real good healthy yeast off if you're adding hops in the beginning of the fermentation. And that's something we've struggled with, is how can we repitch this yeast? And I know brewers that are doing it, but when we check the viability on it and the yeast was full of hop material and everything else, it wasn't something that we wanted to repitch. So we're working through that right now.
Of course, hops is a natural preservative, so it probably doesn't get along well with the yeast, right?
Yeah, we did see a decrease in the yeast viability at the end of the fermentation. You know, normally it's about 95%, and this yeast came off at about 80. So it's like, this probably is not something we want to repitch. And, you know, we're going to try it, and I suspect that there are a lot of New England IPA brewers out there that are repitching the yeast, but we just didn't feel comfortable with it to start with.
Yeah, we had Randy Mosher on, and I think Stan Hieronymus talking about this biotransformation thing that's going on. It's very interesting. Stan, in particular, had an episode we did with thiols, and they actually play a critical role, as well as the geraniol and other things you were talking about. They're very interesting, if you hadn't seen that.
Thiols are so important, and everybody focuses on oils, and I think now, and Stan probably knows as much about this as anybody, but you know, the thiols being in minuscule concentrations are providing tons of flavor. And so the people that are studying this stuff are really learning a lot about it. It's fascinating to go to conferences and get updates on this.
Yep. Well, I've heard conflicting guidance on where the haze comes from. But do you think it comes mostly from the grain bill, or do the hops play a significant role?
I think it's both. I think it's mostly hops. I think the grain bill is helping. But, you know, the hopping rates that people are using in these beers are incredibly high compared to what we used to use in the past. So, you know, for, you know, a long time, 2 pounds per barrel in the dry hop was incredibly aggressive. And I know New England IPA brewers and hazy IPA brewers that are using 5 to 6 pounds per barrel in their dry hop. So a lot of the polyphenolic material is coming from the hops that are creating the haze. And I think the hops play a probably more significant role in the haze than the grain bill. But I do think the grain bill is important, and having all those proteins from those non-barley grains helps with the haze stability. The one thing that haze shouldn't be, in my opinion, and this is just me, and I know there's brewers that feel differently about it, but it shouldn't be yeast. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the yeast, it will continue to generate flavors if it sits in the beer, and also settles out and forms kind of a sludge in the bottom of the can as it sits and ages, or in the keg. So I don't think, my opinion is, I don't think the yeast should contribute to haze. You should get the yeast out of there.
And I assume problems with hop creep too, if you leave too much yeast, right?
Right. You know, and these are beers that should finish. This is another difference between New England IPA and traditional or more traditional West Coast IPA, is that these beers finish at a higher gravity. You know, they're 3.5-4 Plato. There are brewers that are adding lactose to try and get a little bit more residual sweetness in the beer. And that's a key difference as well. You know, you're not trying to ferment it out to complete dryness. You're trying to have some body to help balance out all these other flavors that are going on.
Well, walk us through real quick a recipe. Maybe what would it look like, rough percentages of, ingredients as far as the grain bill, and then also what does your hop schedule look like?
Yeah, so what we've done for most of our beers is we use about 50% pale malt. we would then have, 20% wheat malt, 20% oat malt, and then 10% flaked oats, something like that. We would add lactose at about, maybe 10% of the carbohydrate content is lactose. Trying to put that into a pounds per barrel or pounds per gallon number is—it's more than I can do in my head right now.
That's okay. We have software for that.
Okay, cool. And actually, I use your software to do that. So lactose would go in during the boil, but the grain bill would be 50% pale malt and then a mix of non-barley malted and non-malted flaked grains. And then for the hopping, I'd go very low, minimal on the boil hops, just try to get the boil hops just enough to keep the foam down, basically. There's a lot of brewers that don't do any boiling, no 60-minute additions at all. If we do that in our brewery, our wort foams too much, so we add just enough to keep the foam down, which usually contributes about 10 to 15 IBUs in the finished wort. And then everything else goes in the whirlpool, and we are targeting, we usually use a blend of hops in the whirlpool, and we target probably about 40 to 50 IBUs from the whirlpool hop addition. So it's pretty substantial, 1 to 2 pounds per barrel per variety. So somewhere in that range. It's a lot of whirlpool hops.
Yeah, that's quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned using a lot of dry hops as well during active fermentation.
Yeah, so we do at 24 hours into fermentation, we'll add 2 pounds per barrel and a dry hop. And what we do with the Hazy Like a Fox is a pound per barrel each of El Dorado and Azaka. But we've pretty much stuck with that ratio. And then as we go through fermentation and start pulling the yeast out and ready for a post-fermentation dry hop, we go higher on that addition, 2 to 3 pounds per barrel total. A lot of brewers are, like I said, are going 5 pounds per barrel on this edition, but I've gotten beer that tastes good using less, and I don't want to lose too much of my beer to the hop sludge in the bottom of the fermenter. So it's everything's a balance, and you have to balance production realities with flavor and the flavor you're trying to get. But we haven't found a big advantage to adding a ridiculous amount of hops. We get plenty of hop character with the fermentation addition and then a 2 to 3 pound per barrel addition post fermentation. And that seems to work really well for us.
Nice. Well, excuse me. You have the other topic we want to talk about very briefly, and we've got a few minutes left, is doing lower IBU IPAs. And it's something I've been very interested in lately because I'm not a big fan of the really insanely hopped IPAs. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you certainly see that a lot here. We've seen the zero IBU IPAs and things like that. And I think the key thing to watch out for there is having a balance of hop flavor and hop bitterness versus the malt. So if I'm going to do a low IBU IPA, I'm not going to use a lot of specialty malts that are going to make the beer taste too sweet or too full. I'm going to keep it fairly dry. But it's interesting, the hops, the antiseptic properties of hops are important, but people that are brewing these low IBUs or zero IBU IPAs are not having issues with micro, and it is because they're dry hopping and whirlpool hopping. And this is a great place to try the cold whirlpool hopping technique, I think, and getting very little isomerization, getting all sorts of hop flavor. But it's, I think it's an interesting thing because bitterness is such an acquired taste. And a lot of people really, I think a lot of people don't really like bitterness and get turned off by it. And I think that's really fueled a lot of the growth of IPA and the growth of craft beer over the last few years, is that brewers are making lower IBU versions that have a lot of hop character. So you can talk about the hops and you understand the hops, but you don't have the bitterness there that makes it challenging to drink. And I think it's getting a lot of people to drink craft beer, honestly. I think it's really kind of a cool thing. And, there's the traditionalist in me and the stone brewing person in me, is like, yeah, it's got to be 70 IBUs. but you know what? There's room for everything. And so I think it's kind of a cool development. And I think it appeals to a lot of people because you get all the hop intensity without the bitterness.
Yeah. I mean, what turns me off actually is a lot of really intense IPAs. I get a lot of the vegetal material picking up, you know what I mean?
You get
sort of that vegetal finish to it. And rather than tasting like, you know, a juicy IPA or something like that, sometimes I get more like lawnmower flavor.
Yeah, that's no good. I don't like that either. and I think that has a lot to do with hop residence, you know, and how much time the hops sit in the beer. And, you know, a lot of brewers, what they've gone to doing is using multiple stages of dry hops. So they'll dry hop, and then 2 days later, they'll get those hops out of there, and then they'll add more hops. And that's a good way to kind of reduce any of those vegetal and grassy characters from forming, you know, just getting the hops out quickly. Because you get, there have been studies that show that you get most of the flavor you want out of the hops within 24 hours of a dry hop. And that was some work that Oregon State University did a few years ago. And that's something that you can kind of take to the bank, because I think it's, based on my experience, it's true. At Stone, we had a 5-day residence rule for dry hops, and we kind of backed that off to 3 days. Because we were getting everything we wanted at 3 days. And, if we went beyond 5 days, then we started getting the grassy stuff, and we don't want that. So, and we've kind of followed the same here, you know. The only reason to leave the hops on longer than 2 or 3 days is if they have trouble settling out, and you want to make sure you get them out of the beer. So that may be the only reason to really extend that residence time for the dry hops.
And your thoughts on achieving a good IPA balance? What is the proper balance for a good IPA?
You know, I think it depends on the IPA substyle. You know, it's if you're doing a West Coast IPA, you want a lot of hops, but you also want a lot of bitterness, and you want minimal malt balance. If you're doing a New England IPA, you've got to get some maltiness in there and some body to balance it out. Session IPAs, I think, the low alcohol IPAs are the hardest ones to get a good balance on, because, you know, alcohol adds so much to the balance of beer. And if you have 4% alcohol, the beer by its very nature is going to be thin. But if you start adding too much specialty malts or things to kind of up the malt body and balance, you risk the beer becoming too sweet. And so there's a real fine line with those low alcohol IPAs about how to get the right balance. So it's really style dependent, but I do think, you know, you don't want to overwhelm one versus the other. You got to have some balance. And even in a brewed IPA, you need to have some balance, and the alcohol helps provide the balance in a brewed IPA. You know, typically, 6 to 7% alcohol is going to give you the perception of body and sweetness that may not really be there analytically. And so that's a good way to do it. But I think the real challenge is with the lower alcohol ones.
Well, Mitch, I want to get your closing thoughts on IPAs and where the industry's going next. I'm really good at predicting the past, but I know you're better at the future, right?
I don't feel like I'm good at all at predicting the future. I have no idea. This hazy IPA, New England IPA thing, I think caught everybody by surprise, and how popular it's become. I don't know what's going to happen. I think, honestly, I'm hoping there's room for every style of IPA that people are brewing, because I all think they're wonderful in their own way. And I do think that hop-forward beers are going to continue to be the norm for craft. But what we hear from industry experts is lower alcohol and lower bitterness beers are going to continue to gain in popularity. And whether these are golden ales and things like that, or whether they're session IPAs or just the lower IBU IPAs that we're seeing a lot of here in the Southeast, it's going to be interesting to see how IPAs continue to develop and other beer styles, what takes off. You know, it's a lot of brewers now are doing the American lager, golden lager kind of beers, you know, that are, you know, 12 IBUs and have some adjunct in them and aren't a lot different than what the big guys are brewing. And they're doing a great job with them, and they're very popular. And I think what's fueling that is this desire on the part of beer drinkers to stay local with their beer choices. And, you know, instead of, you know, if they can buy a nice American lager that's brewed by the brewery down the street instead of buying something that's made by some big worldwide conglomerate, you know, I see people going more down that road. And so that's going to be very interesting to see how that develops over time, because certainly a craft brewer can't compete on a price point with these beers with the big brewers. But, you know, I see a lot of them coming out. We just did one. It's called United Craft Lager, and it's doing pretty well for us. And it's been kind of fun and a challenge to brew. But, you know, who knows? It's everything is cyclical in this business. And I'm starting to see a turn back towards West Coast IPAs a little bit. But I think the hazy train is going to go on for a long time.
Well, Mitch, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you again for being here.
Thanks, Brad. It's always fun.
Again, my guest today was Mitch Steele, brewmaster at New Realm Brewing Company. He's also the author of the book, IPAs, Brewing Techniques, and the Evolution of Indian Pale Ale. Mitch, thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A big thank you to Mitch Steele for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.